You're listening to Feminist Current, making waves in the mainstream. Welcome to Feminist Current. I'm your host, Megan Murphy. Today on the show, we'll hear from writer and environmental activist Derek Jensen. Derek is the author of a number of books, including A Language Older Than Words, A Culture of Make-Believe, and Endgame. He spoke with me over the phone recently about activism, social change, how to stay motivated and avoid burnout in doing activism, and what we need to do as a culture to stop the destruction that's become so much a part of our daily lives and social makeup. Here is that interview. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with me.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for wanting to set it up.
I read A Language Older Than Words in, I think, about 7 years ago, And it had a really big impact on me. So,
Well, thanks.
I feel excited to finally be talking to you.
Yeah.
So much of your work is centered around the idea that we are a destructive culture. We're self-destructive, and we're destroying ourselves and the world around us. So, as you know, obviously this is a big question, but why do you think people are so complicit? Why do you think people go along with this so willingly?
There are a lot of reasons. And one of them is that it's a great line by Upton Sinclair: it's hard to make a man understand something when his job depends on him not understanding it. And I would switch that a little bit and get rid of the sexism also and say, it's hard to make people understand something when their entitlement depends on them not understanding it. And it's extraordinary that you know, what do all of the so-called solutions to global warming have in common, and presented by the mainstream? And what they all have in common is they all take industrial capitalism as a given, and the natural world as that which, never who, must conform to industrial capitalism. And that's literally insane in terms of being out of touch with physical reality, because without a real world, you don't have any social system. So any social system has to be secondary to the real world. I mean, that's what you do when you try to figure out a solution to something, is you take the physical conditions and then you map your solution to that. Oh, it's like after Fukushima, there was a Japanese minister, like Minister of Energy or something, who said that the reason they have to continue with nuclear is, he said, we cannot imagine living without electricity. That's an extraordinary statement for a number of reasons. One is that humans lived perfectly fine without industrially generated electricity until maybe 100 years ago. And the other thing that's really extraordinary about it is, when was the last time you ever heard a public figure say, we cannot imagine living without polar bears, or we cannot imagine living without rainforests, or we cannot imagine living without living oceans? You know, we can't imagine living without a living planet. You know, they can imagine living without a living planet better than they can imagine living without the internet. And there's a couple more directions I want to go with this, which one of them is that John Livingston wrote a really good book called The Fallacy of Wildlife Conservation. And one of the things he talks about in there is that if you put anybody into a sensory deprivation situation, one of the things that will happen is they start to hallucinate. And we often think of cities as places of sensory overload. You know, every time I go to a city, like on tour, when I'm done with my event, I always go back to my hotel room and pull the curtains shut and don't open them again, because I just feel so abraded from being around so many sharp corners and so many people all day. But it really isn't a place of sensory overload. Instead, it's really a place of sensory deprivation, he says. And I really agree with this, because, and here's the important thing, is that all of your perceptions are either generated by or mediated by one species, which is not how we evolved. We evolved hearing birds. We evolved hearing wind in the trees. We evolved hearing all these other voices. And that's how we've lived for most of our existence. And the fundamental difference between Western and indigenous ways of being is that indigenous peoples generally perceive listening to the natural world as the way the world really is, as the world consists of all these other beings to enter into relationship with, as opposed to all these other objects to be exploited, all these other resources to be exploited. So the tree would have something to say, this tree would have something to say, and this tree would have some other thing to say. And the point is that what John Livingston says, which I really agree with, is if you're in sensory deprivation like that, you begin to hallucinate. And what he means by that is you begin to perceive that humans are the only ones who matter. And, of course, we have entire, and in fact, I feel comfortable saying this as a white male, but, of course, white people are the only ones who matter, and males are the only ones who matter, and I'm sure you won't object to that.
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, I would say that white males who write books are really the only ones who matter.
Right.
And I need to be really clear so I don't get stabbed by anybody that I'm being completely ironic with all this. But the point is that I think the biggest problem, and we're going to come back, I'm going to come back to your question in a second, but, you know, the biggest problem facing us today and biggest problem facing the world is human supremacism. And I think that that's one of the reasons that we go along is that, and it's the, and also white supremacism, the supremacism in general, the white supremacism, the civilized supremacism, the notion that this way of life is the best. And so we don't question, we're complicit in a lot of it. I mean, think about this just on a tangible level. I realized a few years ago that I actually touch plastic more than I touch human flesh. And, you know, one of the things I say is that, like, in this moment, how many machines are within 20 feet of you? And how many wild, non-human beings, plants, animals, mushrooms, anything, are within 20 yards of you? And how many machines do you have a daily relationship with? And how many non-humans do you have a daily relationship with? So part of the reason that we don't, that we're so complicit, is because what we perceive as real, as more real, is, you know, computers, the internet, refrigeration. That's more real to us and more important to most of us than the real physical world. And then there's another thing I want to bring into this, which is that R.D. Lang came up with the three rules of psychiatrist. Very interesting guy because brilliant, brilliant analysis and a complete abusive jerk. So whenever I think about him, it's just weird because he nailed these dynamics. You know, he absolutely described these dynamics perfectly, but he was such an abusive person. Anyway, leave that aside, but he came with three rules of a dysfunctional family, which I think are also three rules of a dysfunctional culture. And rule A is don't. And rule A1 is rule A does not exist. And rule A2 is never discuss the existence or non-existence of rules A, A1, or A2. So what this means within the context of a dysfunctional family, is an abusive family, is you can talk about anything you want except for the violence you have to pretend isn't happening. And then, of course, you can't talk about the fact that you can't talk about the violence that you have to pretend isn't happening. You can't talk about the fact that you can't talk about the fact. You can talk about Olympics. You can talk about all sorts of other sports. You can talk about politics. You can't talk about the alcoholism. You can't talk about the violence. And it's the same on a larger scale. We can talk forever about the Olympics, we can talk forever about, oh my gosh, I thought that Tom Cruise and Katie Holmes were going to last as a marriage. So we can talk about that forever. What is going to happen with Surrey, you know? But we can't talk about, you know, the systematic murder of the planet. You know, I've obviously also written a lot about men raping women, and, you know, the gold standard studies are that 25% of all women are raped in their lifetime, and another 19% fend off rape attempts, and all the women I know say those figures are low. And, you know, you do the math on this, and you come up with a figure of at least about 900 million women living right now, and Eve Ensler uses higher numbers, but so let's go with the conservative number and say about 1 billion women living right now have been sexually assaulted. You would think that if there was any sanity whatsoever, that this would be like front page news every day, and there would be attempts to do something about this. But instead, let's talk about, what's that horrible bestseller, 50 Shades of Grey or something?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and one more thing about this, and this is a trivial thing in some ways, but it just bugs me, that, you know, the girl with the dragon tattoo, that book was flawed, but at least there was a woman who's fighting back against patriarchy. And then, I don't know if you know this, but when they Americanized it, when they did the U.S. film, they put out a promotional poster that had the actress who plays Lisbeth standing without clothes on with Daniel Craig standing behind her with his arm around her waist. Of course, her breasts are showing, and he's sort of standing there protectively.
Yeah, I saw that, yeah.
I watched like 2 minutes of the beginning of it, and the opening music was a song by Led Zeppelin. And, you know, Led Zeppelin was one of the most horribly misogynist bands of the 70s. It's like, this is not the approach I would take to a movie about a woman fighting back against rape.
No, they turned her into an object of the male gaze.
Yeah, exactly. It's well, we've already drifted a bit far afield, but but my point in bringing that up really is that it's I hate this term because it's used so much, so sillily, and I'm going to use it just as in just as silly a fashion as everybody else. But it's like holographic, you know. It's like every part just manifests that same denial and manifests every part of our culture manifests that same denial and the same worldview, really. So why are we so complicit? I mean, you've got. I think one of the best lines I ever wrote was in my book, Culture and Make-Believe, where I wrote that any hatred felt long enough no longer feels like hatred. It feels like religion or politics or economics or just the way things are. And my point with that is that, you know, if you live in a culture that is misogynist, that's deeply misogynist or deeply nature-hating, then if you're raised in that, you don't perceive it as misogynist or nature-hating. You perceive it as just the way things are. And you have to do a lot of work to decolonize.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested in social change. And I'm particularly interested in the way that in our culture, in Western cultures, you know, particularly in North America, change is individualized. So we're made to feel as though the only things that we can do are in terms of the environment, for example, things like recycling or buying green products, you know, using cloth bags, et cetera, et cetera. And at the same time, many of us realize or we feel as though as individuals, those things aren't necessarily going to make any real impact, especially when we look at the harm caused by corporations and industry. You know, whatever we can do as individuals pales in comparison. And I know that you're also critical of that idea that personal change is the same as social change or that personal change can create political change. But so, you know, what do we do? What can individuals do in face of such huge obstacles? You know, I'm worried that many of us, I mean, I go through this myself, feel like, well, you know, I can't do anything. So how do we stay motivated in terms of affecting change if we also believe that individual actions are sort of useless almost?
Well, I think that worse than useless, I think that they're a distraction. You know, I live pretty cheaply myself, but that's mainly because I'm a cheapskate. You know, it's not a political act. And I use scratch paper till there's every little piece has been written on, but I think that's more some sort of OCD than it is actually helpful. But the point is that in the 1980s was the first time that the corporate press called people consumers more often than it called them citizens or human beings. And that's an extraordinary transformation that takes place, is if those in power can get you to perceive yourself not as a citizen, but as a human, but as a consumer, then your range of resistance is much lessened. And, you know, as a consumer, your choices are basically buy, not buy. And as a citizen, your choices are buy or not buy, or organize a boycott, or organize something else, or vote, don't vote, petition, and when a government becomes destructive of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it. You can revolt. And there's another transformation that has taken place that was several thousand years ago that was just as wrenching, which was the transformation that we had from human members of a community to citizens of a state. Because human members of a community, animal human members of a community, remember that we need habitat, and when our family is attacked, when our community is attacked, we remember that we have teeth and claws. And so my point in bringing all this up is I think the first thing we need to do is, like so many indigenous people have said to me, to decolonize our hearts and minds and to see it for what it is. And one of the ways I talk about this is if space aliens came down from outer space, because where they come from, if aliens came down from outer space and they were systematically vacuuming the oceans and were deforesting the planet, were changing the climate and were killing the oceans and were putting docks in every mother's breast milk and they were putting endocrine disruptors into all of us. And I think that if the space aliens were doing this, the conversations that most of us have would be a little bit different, in that we would be talking about how we're going to resist and how we're going to take out the infrastructure of these space aliens to stop them from being able to murder the planet. So I think what we can do is the first thing is to recognize that there's a problem and to recognize what the problem is. Like one of the first things I said is that all the so-called solutions to global warming, they take industrial capitalism as a given and industrial civilization as a given. And I think that it's like a doctor friend of mine says that the first step toward cure is proper diagnosis. And so I think the first thing that we have to do in terms of resistance is to recognize where the problem is, which is the social system itself, and to think very clearly about that. And then after that, I think that what we need to do is we need to have organized political resistance. And what I mean by that is we need to have organized resistance that is commensurate. It's like, okay, most of us don't think very clearly. It's like people say, how can we help salmon to survive? But what they're really asking when they ask how can we help salmon to survive is how can we help salmon to survive without removing dams, without stopping industrial agriculture, without stopping industrial forestry, without stopping industrial fishing, without stopping the murder of the oceans? The answer is you can't. It's like when they ask how can we stop global warming, they're not asking how we can stop global warming. They're asking how can we stop global warming and still have car culture and still have refrigerators and still have the industrial generation of electricity and on. And the answer is you can't. So I think if what you want to do is you want to help save salmon, then okay, so we need to, what's killing salmon? Dams, industrial fishing, industrial logging, industrial agriculture, the murder of the oceans, global warming. Okay, so you want to save salmon? You can't do all that. You know, you're just one person. I'm just one person. So what we need to do is, you know, take on one of those. And then, okay, so next is, how are you going to remove dams? Well, there's a bunch of ways you can do it. One is you can attempt to make it so that they don't get their licenses renewed, and then they have to go through the process of taking them out. And that's a political process. That's one way. The salmon don't really care whether the dams come out because various interest groups came to agreement to remove dams or because somebody took them out all by themselves. It doesn't really matter to the salmon, I don't think. When people ask me what they should do, I always give a bunch of answers, which is I can't tell you what to do because I don't know you. But there are some areas that guide me, some questions that guide me and I think guide some other people. One of them is, what are the largest, most pressing problems that you can help us solve using the gifts that are unique to you and all the universe? What are the largest, most pressing problems that you can help to solve using the gifts that are unique to you and all the universe? And a great example of this is I've got a friend who used to run the Battle Women's Program for the state of New York. And she's fabulous. She's so wonderful. Every man she sees, I swear, every man she sees, she'll go up and she'll say to him, what will it take for men to stop being a woman? Seriously, I got in a taxi cab with this woman, and she asked the driver, you know, like, could you please take her to Central Park, and what's it going to take for men to stop being a woman? And, I mean, don't get on the subway with this woman. She's just incredibly intense. It's wonderful. And I would never suggest to her that she needs to work on issues surrounding salmon, because she's got her issue, and she also is really good at it. And people have said to me, Derek, why don't you stop writing and be an organizer? I was like, my clothes are on a pile on the floor, you know? I can't even organize my clothes, much less, like, organize a group. So it's like I have no gift for that. Or people have said, you know, gosh, Derek, why don't you blow up dams? And it's like my only D in college was an advanced quantitative analysis chemistry lab, you know? It's like you do not want me touching anything that can possibly explode. You don't even want me mixing, like, a cake mix, you know? So the point is that we have different gifts. You know, find what your gifts are. And the next question I ask is, what do you love? Because, you know, we all love different things. And, you know, my friend who ran the Battered Women's Program for the state of New York, you know, she went on her primary issue. You know, we can't fight at all. So, you know, what are your gifts? And then what are the issues that you really care about? And then another one is I was out hanging out with this wetland specialist one day. We're trying to stop this developer, so-called, from destroying a neighborhood by destroying a forest and putting in houses. And there's different protection if there's wetlands there, so better protection. So he was determining if some of the soils were wetland soils. And the way he did it was by digging in the soil and then rubbing the soil between his fingertips and comparing the color of the soil to this chart. It would help him tell if they were wetland soils. And I'm watching him do this, and I say, so do you get off on doing this? He says, oh, yeah, this is my second favorite thing to do after playing with my dogs. And I started laughing. I said, this is so great because I actually would not enjoy doing this, but on the other hand, by being a writer, I've condemned myself to a life of homework. And, you know, I get off on trying to figure out the relationship between perceived entitlement, atrocity, and exploitation. You know, mm-hmm. I totally get off on that. So that's another thing, is how do you stay, you know, if you're going to be doing some work, some activist work, how do you stay so you don't really get burned out? And part of it is by doing something you get off on. And I love sort of get off as opposed to love. Because what do you love doing? You know, I love taking romantic walks on the beach, you know, whatever. It's really hoity-toity. But, you know, get off is like, what do you just get off on doing? And so that's what I suggest to people is, first off, you know, look at the larger picture. Start, you know, first step toward cure is proper diagnosis. Figure out what the problems are. And then after that, figure out where you can fit yourself in. And then, you know, I talk about organized political resistance, and I think it's, I mean, one person can't stop the culture. We do need organization. But then that's also sort of a soft suggestion, because some people work better. I mean, I'm very much of a loner, you know, and I'm very much of an introvert. And so I remember one night I was working with this activist organization. I work fine with other people. I collaborate well. But there are, like, I was working with this activist organization. They wanted to do a phone tree where they're all calling members of the, you know, like 800 people in the community or in the organization. They're all calling to announce something or another. And I spent the whole evening dialing 6 of the 7 numbers of a phone number, and then I couldn't dial the last one because I was so scared to do cold calls.
Mm-hmm.
I can't do it, you know? I just can't do it. So we all have different gifts we can do, and, you know, find the places that work for you. And, you know, the big distinction is between those who do something and those who do nothing. The big distinction is not between those who are militant and those who aren't. So I want to say one thing, too, about this whole thing about where do we start, which is the smartest thing I ever did in my life, is I got started in activism. I don't know if you've ever heard the story. But when I was about 25 or 26, I realized I wasn't paying enough for gas. That, you know, the social and ecological costs of gasoline are way, way more expensive than the cost of gas. And I knew, you know, there's so many problems, and what are we going to do about them? And I don't know how to start. It's like so big, I can't do anything. So what I decided to do is, for every dollar I spent on gasoline, I would give a dollar to a local environmental organization. But I didn't have any money. You know, I was really poor. So instead what I would do is I would pay myself $5 an hour to do activism. So at that time, it cost about $10 to fill your tank with gas. And I would fill my tank with gas at that point about once a week. So basically, at the end of the week, I spend $10 on gas. Okay, now I have to do 2 hours of activism. And it was great because it was a tangible, easily reachable goal. And so I started writing letters to the editor. I started doing, like, I went down and did some anti-fur protests. I did some anti-circus protests. And I didn't let my ignorance get in my way either. You know, I went down to do the protest, and they handed me a sign. I'm standing, you know, so protests are kind of useless. But, you know, it was a good way to get started. And I'm standing with a sign, and somebody comes up and says, so what's wrong with circuses? And I said, I don't know. Ask the guy next to me, you know? And it was great because I did this for a little while, and then I started having so much fun with the activism, I stopped keeping track of the hours, and it got me started in this.
I want to kind of wrap up by asking you another really big question. You know, where would you like to see us headed as a culture? So ideally, you know, what's the best case scenario? What would be the utopia? And, you know, can we exist in congruence with technology and at the same time not be, you know, a dysfunctional or a destructive culture? Like, where would you like to see us go?
Well, no. This level and this form of technology are killing the planet, and they are absolutely antithetical to real human existence. And so the answer is no. And there's a longer discussion we can have, but I'm just going to mention Lewis Mumford's democratic authoritarian technique. So technology does not emerge from a vacuum. You know, I live on Talawa land. The Talawa lived here for 12,500 years. And it's not the case that they did not invent backhoes because they were too stupid. They didn't invent backhoes because their worldview was entirely different. And technologies emerge from and lead to, there's a social interplay between a technology and the culture, and it will emerge from a certain sort of culture, and it will create a certain sort of culture. And Lewis Mumford had the brilliant, brilliant analysis that, and he called the interplay between the technology and the culture a technics. And he had this brilliant analysis that there were democratic and authoritarian technics. And I'm going to sort of take it a slightly different direction than he did, but basically my perspective on it is that a democratic technic would be one that emerges from and leads to democratic governance, community self-governance. An authoritarian technique would be one that leads you to rely on distant authorities. And one way I look at this is the difference between a bow and arrow and a gun. A bow and arrow, anyone can make them. On the other hand, a gun requires metals and requires bullets, requires gunpowder, and unless you have all of those in your community, you are reliant upon a distant governing system. Or a better example is people think that solar photovoltaics are so groovy. But here's the deal, is that passive solar is a democratic technique because anybody can do it. I can do it in my backyard. I can sit facing the sun. An authoritarian technique is one where you're reliant upon distant authorities. For solar photovoltaics, you need a mining system. And for mines, you have to have an authoritarian system because you have to take the land from someone in order to build the mine. And you have to force people into the mines because nobody goes into a mine if they have options, really. And you can say, well, within a capitalist system, they go in because they get paid. But, A, that's only in the first world. In the third world, they're forced in. And in the first world, one of the reasons they go in is because they're so metabolized into the system and they have had their self-sufficiency taken away. They can't live on the land anymore. So they substitute making money for actually living on the land. But anyway, the point is that authoritarian techniques are not sustainable. And high technology is all authoritarian that way. So what do I want? What's the best case scenario? Honestly, the best case scenario is for this culture to collapse as quickly as possible because it's killing the planet. 200 species went extinct today, and 200 species are going to go extinct tomorrow, and 200 species a day after that. And this culture is reducing, even if you only care about humans, it's reducing the carrying capacity of humans. You know, I went to the Colorado School of Mines, which is an engineering school in Colorado, obviously, and I get their Mines Alumni magazine. I just read this horrible, horrible article a couple days ago about this great thing about this geologist who went out and he discovered this huge silver deposit in Bolivia, and it's wonderful. And then they have this one part of the article where they talk about the fact that this silver deposit happened to be underneath a village that was several hundred years old, and they have before and after pictures, and it's a nice little village, and then the after picture is there's a huge mine there, and all the people have been moved to a compound. So even from a human perspective, you know, if you forget non-humans, human languages are being driven extinct at an even faster relative rate than non-human species. You know, this is destroying indigenous peoples. It's destroying poor people the world over. And so what I want is for this current system to collapse. And what I want in the long run is people ask what I want to replace this culture with, and what I want is to replace it with 10,000 different cultures, each one emerging from its own land base. Because that's the only way you can have cultures that are sustainable and just, is to have them be from their own place. And when I talk about, I want to say this quickly, that when I talk about this culture collapsing, I am not being flippant or glib. I mean, I have Crohn's disease and I'm reliant on high-tech medicines for my life. And when it goes down, I die. So this is not me condemning other people to death. And also at all my talks, I talk about the importance. You know, we know what happens when patriarchal civic society collapses, which is that men's violence against women goes up, which is one of the reasons I am so strong that now is the time that we as males need to make our allegiance to women absolute. And we need to have zero tolerance policies for abuse of women. And we need to set up self-defense so that as this culture collapses, which it is collapsing right now, we're seeing it, that we can make it so women aren't victims yet again.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. Yeah, again, I wish we had more time to talk, and hopefully we'll get the chance to talk more in the future. There's a lot more I could talk about. But I'm so glad that I finally got the chance to interview you. I really enjoyed talking with you, and thank you so much for your work and your writing, and I very much appreciate how much you incorporate feminism into your work and into everything you do as well. Obviously, I see it as all interlocked.
Yeah. Well, thank you for your work, and thank you for saying it's interlocked.
Yeah.
It kind of stuns me that more people don't.
Yeah, and have a really great day.
Thank you. You too.
Okay, take care.
Bye.
Bye.
You just heard an interview with author Derek Jensen. For more on his work, please visit his website at derekjensen.org. That's DerekJensen.org. I'm Megan Murphy, and that is all the time we have for today. Thanks for tuning in to Feminist Current. Feminist Current is a syndicated show produced by Megan Murphy out of Vancouver, BC, Canada. For more information on the show, please visit www.feministcurrent.com. If your station would like to air Feminist Current, you can find episodes at audioport.org or email us at info@feministcurrent.com.